passion, principles, politics. This is Talk Radio 570 KVI.
In for Carlson here, Phil Vandervoort, Talk Radio 570 KVI, the Iraq crisis with ISIS. Syrian jihadists, says the headline, now using Humvees that were seized in Iraq. This is great. These would be, I'm guessing, American Humvees. Jihadists fighting a serious war to put use for the first time American-made Humvees that they seized during a lightning offensive in Iraq earlier this month. Don't we have LoJack on those Humvees? And don't we have an ignition kill switch or something like that? When the car gets ripped, you can disable that thing from remotely. Something else to requisition on the next round of Pentagon budget talks for those Humvees. Let's get to some phone calls here on what we do in Iraq. Kind of got going on this with the distinction between Dick Cheney saying boots on the ground and Kentucky Senator Rand Paul saying no compelling U.S. interest. James calling from Kirkland. Good morning, James. What's your reaction?
It's time for boots on the ground again. Mm-hmm. It probably won't happen because of the confusion and cowardice in the United States. But it's time for boots on the ground again. You know, the collapse of the Iraqi forces was absolutely predictable because the United States was the strong steel that was in the soft steel, you know, of the Iraqi forces mm-hmm. to actually stiffen it and make them functional. We pulled that out, you know, and they fell apart, you know, like soft iron, you know.
So the U.S.
In a fire without anything to harden it.
U.S. military would be the big brother of the Iraqi Shiites in their effort to stand up against the Sunnis.
The U.S. military would add cohesion and moral fiber to what is otherwise a very soft and demoralized Iraqi force. In the same way, you know, in the same way that the quality, which is at the core of any military force, increases the value of all the other forces. You know, the best trained people in the unit increase the capability of everybody else.
And the
United States does not need huge numbers, but has the best quality trained people in the world.
Yeah, there we go.
I think
training wise, you're on.
You take out the cohesion, the communications capability, the discipline, and the example of the American forces who should have been left behind to stiffen Iraqi forces. And those forces fall apart.
In case something went wrong.
Well,
James, hold on just a moment here, James, because Terry's calling from Black Diamond. Terry sees this differently. Terry, you say you agree with Rand Paul. Does James' argument persuade you at all?
Not really. The problem is that when this whole thing got started, there was talk about three independent states in Iraq, the Kurds in the north, the Sunnis in the middle, and the Shiites in the south. Mm-hmm. It went on and on and on and back and forth, and nope, it was nation building, and they were going to be one solid country. Well, it's fallen apart into three sections. The Kurds in the north have started pumping their own oil. Maliki sits there and says, hey, you know, you can't do that. The law says, and the Kurds looked at him and says, you can't fight your way across 150 miles of enemy territory to get back your cities. Mm-hmm. We're not really worried about you fighting across 150 miles of territory to seize oil.
And again, of course they're not worried about that because their force was designed to be dependent upon American participation. You know, it would be essentially as worthless as the South Vietnamese military was after Congress turned off all its ammunition in 1975.
Within
a year, everybody in that government was either dead or in prison or in exile after we pulled the rug out from underneath them. Again, after a similar expenditure of treasure and an even greater number of lives. You know, for years, you know, we had pulled out our troops there. And again, the rug was pulled out underneath the government. We left something stable, and then they pulled the pin out of the wheels, and the wheels fell off. You remove the cotter pins, things fall apart pretty quickly. Now, in the case of Iraq, you know, the argument we're getting, who will die for Mosul, mm-hmm. Rand Paul's specious argument there, is the same as the appeasers who, after Hitler had invaded Poland, For months, we're yelling, who will die for Danzig? And the world sat on its tail for many months and did nothing, the so-called phony world, phony war in World War II, until Hitler turned around and went after France and the lowlands.
Okay, well, James,
you know, we've got a similar situation here. You know, things are burning down, and the appeasers say, oh, well, we can't send our sons and daughters into a Mosul. It's a meat grinder. Well,
James, yeah. I gotta let you go at that point. I'm going to respond to what you're saying here in just a moment, because you make a compelling argument, and I want to respond, but we're up against the break and the news update, so we'll continue along with that and the role of U.S. military advisors that are coming up in Iraq. Let's wrap up what the great conversation we had going with listener James and this differentiation between former Vice President Dick Cheney saying that we need to send in U.S. troops to Iraq to combat ISIS and Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, who says, no, if the Iraqis can't stand up for themselves to fight for Mosul or one of the other cities, Baji or north of Baghdad, then why on earth would we send in U.S. troops to do what the Iraqis refuse to do themselves? And James made some very compelling arguments that if the U.S. has a military presence, has boots on the ground in Iraq, this could be the steel, the strengthening force that the Iraqi security forces need to be able to stand up against ISIS. And by virtue of the U.S. complete withdrawal that President Obama authored, that's why we're seeing this vacuum of power and ISIS, the Sunni-dominated group, spreading from Syria into western Iraq and northern Iraq. And so we kind of are on this balancing point, based on what you heard from James, about being containment or isolationist. And Dick Cheney has criticized Kentucky Senator Rand Paul for his comments as being isolationist. And I'm right now in camp with Rand Paul. Until something more drastic changes, I would be against putting any U.S. military force into Iraq. This is a problem that Iraq is probably going to have to solve for itself. I think the other aspect of this is, if you've got the Sunnis and the Shia that are going after each other, well, that means they've got fewer things to go after as far as Western targets go. I think there's something to be said for this idea that if they're warring with each other, it makes it difficult for them to war with others. And James said that it was the only, you know, basically he framed it as the U.S. is really the only one that can respond and should respond. And I have a tough time buying that argument because, you know, the U.S., we just simply cannot do what Iraq won't do for itself. And that would be, you know, James is talking about going back in there as part of a containment strategy. Also with Iraq, military advisors, this is something that we kind of briefly touched on in the previous segment when we had a couple of calls on the air going back and forth about whether or not the U.S. needs to put boots on the ground in Iraq. President Obama announced 300 military advisors will be dispatched to Iraq in an effort to try and combat ISIS and the insurgency through various parts of western and northern Iraq. And let's get you a little history on the use of military advisors by the United States. Let's start with the Vietnam era. U.S. involvement began with the deployment of fewer than 1,000 military advisors to Vietnam in the late 1950s by President Eisenhower. But over the next couple of years, that ended up mushrooming. According to the Associated Press story, U.S. personnel grew to more than 16,000 in the year 1963 and 23,000 in 1964. And ultimately, more than 500,000 Americans were fighting in combat in Vietnam by 1968. Central America. During the Cold War and the Reagan administration, the U.S. trained thousands of Latin American soldiers as part of an effort to secure the alliance of states in Central America. In the Ronald Reagan administration, Americans offered training to Costa Rica's national police force against threats from the Nicaraguan-trained socialist rebels. And the U.S. poured advisors into Honduras and El Salvador. And that was all part of the Iran-Contra situation. And then even today, military advisors, U.S. military advisors, specifically Army Green Beret, Navy SEALs, Air Force Spec Ops, they all perform a limited mission all over the world year after year. And the mission falls into the category of, quote, foreign internal defense, end quote, which helps foreign armies develop skills, tactics, and firepower needed to defend their country against internal threats, such as insurgencies like what we're seeing right now with Iraq. But generally, all these missions go down without any heat of hot war or hostilities. So that's an example of what the U.S. is doing with military advisors all over the world outside of Iraq, even today. And then, of course, for Iraq, President Obama saying up to 300 military advisors, mostly Green Berets, will be deployed in teams embedded with Iraqi security forces at the brigade level and above. So that's how it's going to start. Looking back on Vietnam, could it grow? If the insurgency becomes more extrapolated, you'd have to think that that would be one of the options President Obama would be most likely to choose. But that's all speculation at this point. Among other elements of what's in President Obama's plan right now for Iraq, the creation of what President Obama called Joint Operations Centers. That would be in Baghdad and in northern Iraq. The Joint Operations Centers would share intelligence, coordinate planning, intensify intelligence gathering, and allow for additional U.S. military assets in that region. So that's a little bit of how military advisors that President Obama has dispatched to Iraq will be used. So there's a little bit more context to what we're talking about. Circle back to this conversation that James and I had in the previous segment about the U.S. going into Iraq and really the U.S. stabilizing force going into Iraq to help out the Iraqis, security forces there. Here's a note to consider. And that's the fact that there could be some cannibalization within these insurgent groups. Here's a story that ran in the New York Times over the weekend. Eyewitnesses say a deadly gun battle near Kirkuk had been had broken out between two of the most powerful Sunni militant groups. The battle, they said, pitted the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS, which we've all heard about for the last couple of weeks. They're leading the battle with the Shiite-dominated government, the Nuri al-Maliki government. And ISIS fought against Ba'athist allies, and the gun battles, according to eyewitnesses, left 17 dead. So if you're talking about the idea that the U.S. could be the balancing force to stabilize the Iraqi security forces, I think there's at least a little bit of evidence right there that if the U.S. stays out, perhaps any of these insurgent groups could cannibalize each other. And if we allow them to cannibalize each other, or if we stay out of the way and they potentially cannibalize each other, well, then maybe there's no need for the U.S. to go in. Another element from this New York Times story, check this out. In Tikrit, the morgue at the Tikrit hospital reported that it had received, this is a little grim, if you've got some youngsters maybe in the vehicle with you, this might be a good moment to switch back to me in 2 minutes. Yeah, about 2 minutes. The morgue received 84 bodies of policemen, soldiers, and government employees that had been executed. Seven of them had been beheaded. And this is going to continue to be what I've described as the score settling. Under the Saddam Hussein regime, the Ba'athists took it out on the Shiites. Now that the Shiites are in charge, they have, over the last 8-10 years, have done their share of score settling. And now the Iraqi insurgents, Sunnis, ISIS, they are in position to do score settling against the Shiites. Here's an Associated Press story about all of this and the idea of whether or not the U.S. should get involved with boots on the ground in Iraq. And this comes from the perspective of Iran clerical leadership for Shiite-dominated Iran.
Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said he was opposed to any U.S. intervention in Iraq, appearing to quash speculation that the U.S. and Iran might take a cooperative stance against Iraq's Islamic militants. At the same time, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani called for a ceasefire during the month of Ramadan, which starts on July 1st. In a separate development, Sunni militants controlling a small town in northern Iraq handed over the decomposing bodies of 15 Shiites to authorities in Kirkuk. It's not clear exactly how they died, but area residents, speaking anonymously, said the Shiites had been hung from streetlights and a water tank for days. The incident underscores remarks by President Obama that the Al-Qaeda-inspired militants in Iraq could grow in power and destabilize the region. Ned Barker, Associated Press.
And so that report illustrates as well these atrocities that the Sunni insurgents are committing against the Shiites, which is kind of why I've used this phrase. This is score settling. This is a reason why the U.S. should not be involved.
News and views you can't get anywhere else. This is Talk Radio 570 KVI.
A California group wants to change the U.S. flag. They want to add more stars. I'll tell you what they've got up their sleeves here in just a moment. Been talking about the Iraq situation. You want to jump in on that? 206-421-5757. 206-421-5757. Don is out in Issaquah. Don, good morning. Thanks for calling KVI. Hi.
Good to talk to you on this side of the microphone. Hey, a couple things. I think this country has to sit down with itself and decide who we can trust within our political system and the media, because we cannot allow the political whores of this country to sway us anymore. I think I'm a 55-year-old, and I see very clearly that my job, and I failed in it miserably, is to pass on a country that is safe and prosperous. And so we're going to have to fight these people. We're going to have to fight them now. We're going to have to fight them 10 years from now.
And you mean fight, mean the generic terrorist umbrella of Al-Qaeda?
Exactly.
Is that what you're getting at? Yeah, good.
Exactly. Continue. And I want to make up my mind. I was for going in originally. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any family members or myself fighting, so just for full disclosure, but sure. I was for it. But one thing that really made me uncomfortable the whole time was seeing our warriors being used as police officers and community organizers, and it made me sick. So I want to figure out who we can trust, and most political people on both sides of the aisle, as soon as their lips start moving, I call them a liar.
Oh, yeah,
or because the only way that we can hand future generations the things that I was given, which was pretty much peace and prosperity, is by knowing who we can trust to help us with get the information to make decisions, because we have to fight these people. What is the best way to do it? What is our priorities? And I don't want our warriors to go over there and be police officers and get cut up while they're trying to police savages.
Or people that are just hell-bent on trying to take out their political enemies.
Yes. Yeah. So please help us fight the battle here in this country of separating the patriots from the politicians, from the men and women of honor, mm-hmm. from the people who just want to have a job next year. Yeah. Please, everybody of my generation, let's do something good for the future generations, because we failed miserably in providing the reasons why you want to have honor and your word means something and work ethics. My generation has failed miserably. Just going from here forward, let's do something honorable and decide who to listen to, who to trust, get a game plan, set our priorities, and let's do something that we can be proud of.
Right now, I hear the frustration in your voice, Don, and I'll let you go with that, and I'll try and hopefully maybe give you a couple of possible responses. You kind of referenced that idea of trust. You framed it around the political leaders in the U.S. that we can trust. I would say it's even that would be important enough, but even more important than that, if the U.S. does anything, President Obama sending in 300 military advisors, Dick Cheney saying he wants to put boots on the ground over there, you better figure out who you can trust in Iraq, even more so than who you can trust in the United States government or political leadership. I would say before any decision gets made on sending troops back in, you better figure out who's going to have your back in Iraq. And I don't know that anyone could give a clear or believable answer at this point about that idea. The other idea of if we send in troops, are we going to be fighting with one arm behind our back, which is what we've seen in Afghanistan, which is what we've more or less seen in Iraq prior to this? And this is the most difficult aspect of fighting an insurgency is these punk-ass insurgents, they hide among the women and the children. And we've heard this before, mosques, that, oh, it's, you know, the infidels will explode our mosques. Well, guess what? The Muslims already do that to each other. They'll blow each other's mosques up. They have no compunction about doing that. They'll do that at the drop of a hat. But this idea that if the U.S. is going to go back into Iraq and try and stop this insurgency, are you going to have to fight with one hand behind your back? And that's a double-edged sword in and of itself. If you bring everything that you have to bear militarily to fight insurgents in Iraq, how does that translate? How does that look to the rest of the world, in particular, the rest of the Muslim world? And is that a PR battle you want to get into? The right way to fight would be to go in there and, for lack of a better term, pave the place. Mow it down. But that idea of fighting a war with that outcome does have drawbacks. And I think that's where we get back to Rand Paul saying there's no compelling interest for the U.S. to go in right now. I don't want to see our... I think Don just said it. You don't want to see our U.S. military forces go in there and be a police squad. You don't want to get into being the referee between Sunni insurgents and the Shia. You don't want to do that.